Now, Andrew is the author of a book all about Shakespeare, and I think also about the Shakespeare Festival. Is that correct, Andrew?
That's correct, yes.
So tell us all about it, first of all.
Okay, well, the book starts with connections between Cambridge and Shakespeare in Shakespeare's own lifetime. There were some plays that students put on, satirical plays, where Shakespeare was a target of their satire. So I talk about the reasons for that. Hamlet was performed in St. John's College, well, in Cambridge, possibly St. John's College, in 1601. So I talk about that, and I talk about Shakespeare touring at his time before he got to the Globe Theatre, and at times when he was forced out of London and he had to play in open fields and places like that, which is what the Cambridge Shakespeare Festival does, which is what the rest of the book is about.
So I don't know a whole lot other than what I found out when I talked to David Crilly last week about Shakespeare and the festival and so on. But just in terms of the history of Shakespeare himself, was he one of these people who was recognised whilst he was still alive, or was it afterwards that his full value and talent was recognised?
It's a little bit of a mixture, I'm afraid. There's not an easy answer to that. One of the reasons is we don't have a great deal of records, but undoubtedly he was a success in his own time. And given his background, which was not university educated, a huge success where he came from. But there were other playwrights, and fashions changed. I mean, here we are in a radio station. It was like the pop music of its day. You know, fashions changed very quickly. One of the reasons Shakespeare was forced to tour and possibly come to Cambridge was that there was a sudden fashion for boys' companies. So boys under 12 played all parts in all plays. And all the leading playwrights of the day wrote for it because that was the hit style. You know, it was like moving from hippie to punk or 1980s, you needed a certain producer. Shakespeare didn't in that case. But Shakespeare did follow other fashions. He wrote a kind of gory horror when it was fashionable, satirical comedies when they were fashionable. So they were changing. The demanding the audience was very demanding, and it was novelty hungry.
I guess that's, as you were saying there, I guess that's the thing that you kind of forget, really, that of course there was no radio in those days, no TV. The only entertainment would have been either music, which would have been live, I would imagine, or, as you say, performances on the stage, really. So that would have been the way that people would have really entertained themselves.
It's the way they entertained themselves, it's the way they got news, it's the way they discussed their past. Yes, it was everything. You had balladeers as well, just to keep the music theme going. So you had balladeers who travelled from town to town, singing songs that Shakespeare refers to in his plays as well. But yes, it was very much that way, and it was thought of as, it was populist art, and it was looked down upon. If you were serious, you were supposed to study poetry. You mentioned Shakespeare in his own day, he was far more famous for his poems than he was for his drama. And of course, ever since then, it's been the other way around.
Really? And have we lost the poems along the way?
They still exist. And they're wonderful, but they're not the masterpieces his plays are, but in those days it was considered poetry was the proper moral educated thing to do, and drama was for the ruffians. And then, of course, later on, novels came out and you were supposed to go to dramas because that was the educated thing to do, and novels were populist, so looked down upon. All the way, you can follow it to TV, pop music, the internet now. Parents are always telling their kids what they're doing is wrong and they should do what older people did.
Yes, absolutely. So what's the connection with Cambridge with Shakespeare then?
Well, Cambridge is blessed, actually, because the Cambridge Festival, Shakespeare Festival, it's a wonderful thing. They have 45 actors in Cambridge for 7 weeks with six or seven directors, and they put four plays on every night, Monday to Saturday, plus a Saturday charity performance, which has raised nearly £65,000 so far. And they perform it in Elizabethan costume in the same settings as I talk about in the book that Shakespeare started out in and was sometimes forced into later in his career. And you're playing in the open air, so raining at Macbeth last night. If my voice goes, I'm sorry, blame that. So you're open to the elements, you're in the same light, I'm closer to the actors than I am to you just now. And all of that brings an intimacy and an interaction with the audience that was very much part of the theatre in Shakespeare's day. And you don't get when you go to a conventional theatre. You sit in the darkness, you have to look where the spotlight is, you're separated by a big stage, none of that.
Oh, so it's very much in your face, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, I use that phrase in the book.
Oh, right.
So thank you for that.
So just going back to the book, so have you used the Cambridge Festival as really the main topic of that book?
Yes, it is. Apart from the historical setting at the beginning, which is slightly apart from the rest of it, the book then has two main sections, which is what performing in outdoor tells us about Shakespeare's art in his own time. So I do use the festival all the time as my examples, but any outdoor festival, it would be be applicable to. But then the last bit of the book is about how they run the festival, the practicalities. You can imagine the cost of accommodation in central Cambridge for 7 weeks in the summer for 50, 55 people. You can imagine the problems when you have a very wet season, all kinds of problems. And there's lots of humorous things happen. So there's a whole section on when things go wrong, which I must admit I really enjoyed writing.
And it's quite an unusual topic to pick up there, to write as the theme of the book is to, in effect, document the whole of the festival, really, is what you've done there, I guess. Would you recommend that people would read that book in conjunction with going to see a play?
Oh, that's a very good question. I have to be honest, I would say first and foremost, despite the fact I want people to read the book, first and foremost, I think they should go to the festival. Maybe then read the book and go back to the festival. But I think going to the festival is the most important thing. The book is a celebration of what they do. So obviously, I'm a firm supporter of it. And wonderful though the book is, Shakespeare wrote a little bit better than me.
Right. Now, also, I noticed that in your notes that you were saying that you've got a website, and actually what you're keen to have is some feedback on the book as well.
Yeah, that would be great if people could pick up from here, because not many have so far, possibly because I'm not on social media for various reasons, so I've not alerted people that way. But after every show I write a review, and I encourage people in the audience to write a review. I have got two or three from audience members, and obviously I think it's better than people just hearing my opinion all the time. And it will be particularly good if we get people with different opinions. And I know that the actors and directors are busy just now, but I know that they will respond if people ask questions or say why they think something didn't work. I'm sure we'll get feedback from them because they've been very supportive of the book.
So do you go actually to every single one of the I don't mean to every single performance, but every single play you go and review each of those?
I do, yes. I mean, actually, before I started the book, I was going to every show, and you may have gathered if you've read anything else about me that I tend to be slightly obsessive about things in life. So when I was following music, I have to see about 60 shows a year from the same person. So yes, I went to every show. And also, I go to the evening shows because the light is different from the Saturday afternoon, so the whole performance looks different.
Right, okay. And also, of course, this is your most recent book, but by no means your only book.
No, but all the books before that are on one person, and that's a bard from another generation. That's Bob Dylan, not quite as old as Shakespeare.
So what made you switch to, is it simply your involvement with the Shakespeare Festival?
Yes, it was really the Shakespeare Festival. It changed my view of Shakespeare in many ways, but my last book on Bob Dylan was on his so-called never-ending tour, which started in 1988, the exact same year as the Cambridge Shakespeare Festival started. So I did 26 years of Dylan touring and performing in live art, and there is actually a connection. Dylan never plays the same song, never plays the song the same way twice, and often changes the arrangement. And similarly, every single year at the Shakespeare Festival, you can see Midsummer Night's Dream, but it's never the same actors, never the same director, and anyway, it changes night to night.
Really? Oh, right. I didn't realise.
Well, because of weather and different audience. You can play in front of an audience of 6 one night and 360 the next night. It gives a different dynamic.
Mm. So are you directly involved with the production itself?
No, I leave that to the experts.
Right.
I'm just an observer that asks them endless questions, probably annoy the heck out of them. but they've been very supportive, and they let me know sometimes in advance what they're trying, and I see from my point of view whether I think it works or not, and generally it does. They've got a very high success rate.
So how did you start in publishing then? Well, I mean, what was the first thing you sort of got involved with?
Well, the first thing I got involved with, I became involved in computers before they were widely known, before people had them in their homes, but I could see it was coming. And all my life I'd wanted to write about Bob Dylan, and I could see that with this new technology there would be a way of producing your own magazine. So just about a little bit later than punk, and punk had exploded with fanzines, so credit to them there, in as much as I thought I'll do one on Bob Dylan, and eventually that's what happened. I landed up working in computing. I had a home computer and printer, and I started my own magazine. Fast forward 15 years, I was running another magazine that was professionally published with coloured photographs and went around the world. Well, the first one went around the world too. And in between that, I got an invite to write my first book on Bob Dylan because of the articles I'd been writing. So I sort of went from amateur to professional, kept them both going.
Mm. And I mean, these days, you walk into any store and look at the magazine rack, and there are hundreds upon hundreds of different magazines on pretty much any subject you could think of, really. So is the market for magazines still as vibrant as it used to be, given that we now have the internet, do you think?
No, I don't think it's at all possible that it can be. I mean, it amazes me that that they still survive and seem to flourish as well as they do. You know, I mean, I still read Mojo and Uncut, you know, I follow everything. But a lot of the people who write there have written books on their subjects, and of course, as I've mentioned, I'm slightly obsessive, so I've read all the books in advance, so even though I kind of know what they're going to say, I still like to see them, and you know, kudos to them for keeping going, but I do find it sometimes surprising, you know. I think I must have read about 725 times in these magazines about Bob Dylan arriving in a snowy New York and Bob Dylan introducing the Beatles to marijuana. But somehow the audience keeps growing for those stories. So good luck to them.
So we're coming almost to a close as far as the Shakespeare Festival is concerned. I guess we've only got August now. It finishes at the end of this month.
It finishes on August the 29th. Yes. The last week is usually called the Ghost Week because there's usually only one play. But there's two this year, Timon of Athens and Macbeth. Both of which you should definitely go and see if you're listening. Everybody should go and see it.
Yeah.
And the two of the other ones, Much Ado About Nothing and Midsummer Night's Dream, finished.
Because they switched, didn't they? I know David was saying to me last time we were talking about Shakespeare, that I think he said it was in two halves, that there was four to start and then four afterwards.
That's correct. You remember what he said. You listened to him. No, they did.
That's fairly unusual.
Yeah, it was very good. Saturday was the end of the run, the 3 weeks of the first four.
Right.
And Monday the next four started. And what I think is amazing about that, if I've time to say it, because I think they deserve tremendous credit for this, is that the actors, in the week before, or week and a half before, they're rehearsing all the way through the day the second play they're going to do, and then going out at night and playing the first play. And I watched Andrew Merton, who gave a fantastic performance as Falstaff all of last week. And I saw him in Timon of Athens, a completely different character, on Monday, where he was, if anything, even better. And I couldn't understand how the week before he'd been rehearsing the Timon character and going out and playing Falstaff. I mean, I could never do that. I'm in awe of people who can do things like that.
Oh, that sounds like multitasking, you know, and I'm definitely not in the league.
Me neither.
So which are the four that are running up to the end of August now, then?
The four that are running up to the end of August are Much Ado About Nothing,
right.
Midsummer Night's Dream, Macbeth, and Timon of Athens.
And do you know which college they're playing in?
Timon of Athens is at Robinson College. Macbeth is at King's College. I'm getting a slight problem here. Midsummer Night's Dream's at St. John's, and Much Ado About Nothing's at Trinity.
And the great thing is that they're all, as you said before, they're in the open. And if we, you know, if we're blessed with decent weather, that must be a tremendous experience.
Yes, exactly. It's fantastic. And as you step out of the city, I mean, I normally walk through the centre of town and go to these places. And I walk through the backs, and you kind of get a little bit away from the shopping area and everything when you get to the backs. And then you go into these gardens, some of which, like at King's and Trinity, they're not open to the public. They're not even open to the students. They're the fellows' gardens. You walk into these places, I think King's was opened in 1690 or something, and probably is unchanged. You walk into these places and you're already transported into another time, and I think that's quite a big thing, actually. In fact, I know it is for me, anyway. I think it is for everyone. Because when you come back to the city, it's jarring. You walk back into the centre of Cambridge and it's like, oh no, 21st century, go away.
Okay, so they're on at the moment. And going back to your book then, if our listeners are interested to get a hold of a copy, how can they do that?
Well, multiple ways. It's in the bookshops. It's in Heffer's and Waterstones in the centre of town. I think a few others as well, but it's definitely in those two. They can get it online at the usual places. But I do have a website myself, which is at the back of the festival programme, but very quickly, it's www.a-mur.co.uk/csf/. That's the best way to get it.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, Andrew, thanks ever so much for coming in this morning to talk about your book and also the festival and so on. I wish you well. I hope you have great success with the book and hopefully get along to see some of the plays before they finish at the end of the month.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.